Well, good evening and welcome back to the Journey Home program. I'm your host, John Mark Grodi. And once again, we have this great privilege here on EWTN to share a story with you. Tonight, we're joined by Jeremy McClellan. He's a former Presbyterian and now he works in comedy.
That's right.
And great to have you here tonight.
Thank you so much for having me. It's great to be here.
Yeah, we share a background, the Presbyterian.
That's right, the PCA.
Yeah. My father brought us into the church when I was young. So, excited to hear a bit of your story tonight.
Of course, yeah.
Let's go way back to the beginning. Where does it all begin?
Okay, well, so it starts before I was born, in a way. My parents met at a PCA church. My dad was the adult Sunday school teacher.
Yeah.
And not the, children's Sunday school teacher, but the adult Sunday school teacher.
Right.
That's how he met my mom. And they got married, and I was brought up in that church. And so I'm the third of three boys.
Gotcha.
And so raised PCA, I joke it's like
PCA for a while. Has your family been PCA?
Not my grandparents or anything like that.
Okay.
Both my parents, I think grew up, my dad grew up Methodist.
Okay.
My mom grew up sort of Baptist sort of.
So that's something they'd come to.
They came to the PCA and in Charleston, South Carolina, which is where I'm from and currently live.
Okay.
And they just sort of dove head in. And very well-educated people, very theologically minded, grew up with all these books. And I mean, one thing about being Presbyterian, it's lots of books, lots of knowledge. The sermons are 45 minutes long. And by the time you're 13, you have a master's in Protestant theology, very much more so than I think other denominations. Mm-hmm. There's a very intellectual component to it, which I've always really appreciated.
Yes.
And definitely more of an appreciation for history than a lot of other Protestant denominations. Where there's a real concern to see, at least from where I was, how I was raised, my pastors and elders and everything, a real concern for seeing themselves in the story of the church and in the story of the gospel, rather than just sort of this Bible fell and now we're going to interpret it. There was an interest in seeing themselves in continuity. And so continuity was prized.
Yes.
And, but yeah, grew up in the PCA Calvinist background, and I loved it. I loved reading, and it wasn't just Calvinist authors that I read. I read I read the Summa, and I read Athanasius and all the people, because again there was a desire to see their theology as being sort of in continuity with all of that. Raised and, grew up going to PCA school, went to PCA college. I went to Covenant College in Tennessee, which is a PCA college. I majored in history and, had the whole program down pat. So
again, you had the strong intellectual life and you really identified with the faith. That talk about, again, on the other side, your heart, did you have a relationship with God?
I did. It was not, mediated through as many things as in Catholicism, obviously. Yeah. But yes, it was more intellectual.
Mm-hmm.
Faith for me was sort of getting it right.
Gotcha.
Getting it right intellectually. And at the same time, growing up, in my church and everything, there was a lot of abuse.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of pain, and when you combine those two things, I knew a lot of people who were Calvinists. When you get the total depravity and the sort of things being kind of fallen to their core, all of reality being fallen, mm-hmm. along with violence, you end up with, which is what I grew up with, of a sense of the world and myself that was sort of fundamentally wrong, fundamentally rotten to the core. Not in the sense of having fallen from a place of glory to sort of a normal place, but sort of rotten to the, deeply,
mm-hmm.
and irredeemably almost. But then because of Jesus or whatever, you can have healing from that, but that never really happened. So growing up, there was this obsession that I had, sort of away from the heart and away from, almost like that I could somehow, fix myself. And fix by getting it right, by somehow getting the theology right, getting the ideas right.
Right.
And once you do that, then maybe I'll be fixed or something. So, that was I think a big part of growing up was this love of the church, love of history, love of theology, love of philosophy, but behind it, there was this desire to be whole, to be healed somehow, to sort of finally become a human being, you know, almost.
Yeah.
So I think psychologically that is a lot of the baggage that I had growing up and going through and sort of trying to find theologically my place in the world.
Right. And you mentioned the long sermons. What was worship? What did worship look like?
Worship was a seminar in a ways. You go in there, you sing hymns, you pray, and you don't know what you don't know what's going to happen in the service until you get the bulletin, right? And then once you get the bulletin, you can't plan ahead, right? And you don't know what the reading's going to be, what the sermon's going to be. And the sermon was this very like educated exegesis of scripture, tying it into history or some sort of. The history is always of the Reformation. You know, these arguments, this interpretation of the Bible that came about during the Reformation. So the people quoted were very much like the Reformers. Mm-hmm. At the same time, though, there was not a lot of hostility I felt towards the Catholic Church. A lot of the people in my church were very involved in the pro-life movement, mm-hmm. and so they were among Catholics in that respect. There's different sort of flavors of Calvinism, mm-hmm. and the Dutch flavor of Calvinism, Kuyper and Duyvesant and Bavinck and all these people who came from the more Dutch tradition, they had fairly friendly relationships with Catholics in the Netherlands. Mm-hmm. And so there was not a lot of hostility. There was much more hostility towards liberalism, secularism, mm-hmm. things like that, rather than sort of fighting old battles about, you know, transubstantiation or something like that. Yeah. So in that respect, I'm very thankful for that. There was not a lot of anti-Catholic, but again, you know, you grew up reading Calvin, you go up reading but not so much Luther. So some of the pain of like the original reformers was not there growing up. So I was always sort of open to it. And again, there was a concern for having continuity.
Yeah.
But again, the continuity was a little strained. Like there were these giant gaps. And as interested as I was in church history, you know, I wasn't content with the idea that like Augustine and Aquinas were the only Christians between Paul and Luther.
Right.
And that always made me a little suspicious. You know, you got some of the Catholic writings when you were trying to figure out Nicaea with the Trinity, the doctrines of the Trinity and the Incarnation. How did those come about? And so you got some of those writings. But then after Nicaea, that's the last council that was really appreciated. And so after that, it's kind of like, okay, what happened between that and Luther? And so there's this view that it kind of fell away. There's this gap there. And which, you know, looking at the long history of the church, you can't do. I mean, right. you can't hold that. So
gotcha. So you went to what was the school that you
Covenant
went
to? College.
Okay.
Covenant
yeah.
College.
Yeah.
It's a liberal arts college. It's actually on top of Lookout Mountain, Georgia.
Hmm.
But you have to go to Chattanooga first and then drive up the mountain and then you cross into Georgia at some point.
Huh.
And so we always just said we went to school in Tennessee or Chattanooga. Hmm. But really it's Lookout Mountain, Georgia. And great school. I loved it. Majored in history. My brother went there. One thing I didn't mention was that all my life growing up, since I was like 12, I worked with people with intellectual disabilities.
Huh.
Both my brothers were, we were all in Boy Scouts,
mm-hmm.
and we all grew up going to Boy Scout camp. And also at that campsite was a camp for mentally disabled adults. That because we worked at Boy Scout camp, we would stay 2 weeks after it was done, and we would work with people with disabilities.
Wow,
and
yes.
So my brother went into special education, and so I did that for, you know, like basically from the age of 12 until the age of 30, working with people with disabilities. And I was very interested in, you know, I had this very intellectual upbringing that prized faith as sort of a series of propositions.
Right.
At the same time, I had a deep love and relationship with people for whom propositional belief is not primary, for whom like the sort of intellectual assent to these kind of, you know, they're not smart, like, and that's just kind of how it is.
Right.
And so what does it mean, you know, like the age old question, well, how do they get into heaven?
Mm-hmm.
You know, for Protestants, that's a real question. If someone can't intellectually assent to the faith, and it's always sort of like, oh, well, they get a sort of a discount, mm-hmm. right? Where mm-hmm. they get God just lets them in the back door or something, and that's how people with disabilities get into heaven. Mm-hmm. And whereas for us, it's the sort of beliefs about the Trinity or the Nicene Creed or whatever.
Right.
And I was always very dissatisfied with that, yeah. with the idea that people with intellectual disabilities were sort of a different category than us,
right.
because they weren't smart. Because after all, children are like that too.
Yeah.
And so are old people who start losing their intellectual capacity to actually understand like mm-hmm. the intricacies of the faith. And so what does it mean then, not just to be a Christian, but to be a person, like, because that's like the core at what you get to.
Yeah.
And that tied in with like, what did it mean for me to be a person? Mm-hmm. Like, am I good? Am I like, or am I just this hopelessly fallen, corrupt person
yeah.
who has to sort of fix myself with faith?
Yeah.
And so when it came to people with disabilities, that was my primary obsession for a lot of my life, was like, not just like, I love them mm-hmm. and I love spending time with them and that's what I want to do, but also like the questions that are raised by friendship with people with disabilities. What does that have to do with my faith? And is it kind of an add-on mm-hmm. to theology, or is it actually like the core? Like, does it actually get to the core of theology?
Yeah.
And so one of the things that I was obsessed with at Covenant, at the college, I majored in history, but my main concern and all the stuff that I wrote and studied was the history of disability in the United States, like disability policy in the United States, but also the history of what it meant to be a person mm-hmm. and what it meant for people with... you know, how do we theologically think of the fall? How do we think of the image of God?
Yeah.
How do we think of the relationship between intellect and love and all these things? Like, it gets, you know, people with disabilities, just spending time with them raises these kinds of questions.
Yeah.
And if you aren't thoughtful about it, you will end up in some really weird and very dark places, mm-hmm. Which I think we're, you know, seeing in a lot of, you know, in the United States and also in Canada, in terms of what does it mean? What does suffering mean? Is suffering something to be eliminated at all costs, including the elimination of those who suffer? And so, like, that's what I was obsessed with. So in college, history of disability, the human person, which always in the background was about me, was about, like, what does it mean for me to be a person? Is it just my intellect, which I've always been impressed with myself. You know, I've always liked being smart. I've always liked being clever, being able to trick people. I think that comes a lot into comedy, where I like being smarter. I like being the smartest guy in the room. And, but even more than like being seen as smart, I've always been very obsessed with getting it right, where even if I look stupid, I want to get it right. I don't want to end up in some crazy place. And, yeah, and so what I found in college was this, you know, through all of my research, was that our view of what a human person is, under liberalism especially, is intellect, and especially the ability to produce wealth, the ability to do things of value for other people, to be independent, to not be a burden on other people, and that's our view of what it meant to be a person. And when you look at the history of disability policy and the Americans with Disabilities Act and the supposed progress that we see people with disabilities having in America, it's actually has nothing to do with our value
yeah.
of people with disabilities. It's because of changes in the economy. And now people with physical disabilities can produce wealth mm-hmm. as long as they're smart enough. And because our you know, someone who uses a wheelchair, there's nothing preventing them from participating in the economy now, because everything is remote, everything is, you know, on the internet, and it's very knowledge-driven sector. What does that mean for people with intellectual disabilities? Well, it's worse, because having an able body but not being very smart is you're nowhere now. Mm-hmm. And so we have not changed, I don't think, yeah. our view of what it means to be a human person. We're still just as eugenicist as we were before, if not more so, because now we have the technology supposedly to eliminate human suffering, often through death, but also just like we've made great progress in that regard. But in terms of people with intellectual disabilities, what are they for,
yeah.
right? Why are they amongst us? Mm-hmm. In a lot of places in Europe, They aren't, yeah. right? They've been sort of eliminated mm-hmm. through abortion and through like gene technology is next, where like that's the goal. And right. so all of that is tied into viewing the human person fundamentally as this independent intellectual. But of course, it's not just a class of people. It's also us that will one day be like that.
Right.
We were born that way, mm-hmm. and we will be that way again. And so what does that mean when we get old enough?
Yeah.
And we are no longer independent. When we are, so all of this, and all of this was very, it wasn't just in the realm of ideas.
Yeah.
It was about who I am as a human being. Am I rotten? What does it mean to be a person? Is the world good? It's one thing people who grow up with abuse come to believe, regardless of Calvinism or not, mm-hmm. is that the world is rotten, that there's something deeply disturbing about the world. Mm-hmm. And so, am I rotten? And also, what about the people that I love? What about these people with intellectual disabilities? What does it mean to love them? And what does it mean for them to continue to exist even when they can't remember who they are? You know, a lot of yeah. people with Down syndrome that I took care of, people don't know this, most people with Down syndrome will get Alzheimer's when they reach the end of their lives, mm. which is often around 40, you know, 50 years old.
Yeah.
And so what does it mean for me to, for them to continue to be my friend even though they don't remember me?
Yeah.
And this is true, I'm sure a lot of people can relate to this with their parents and grandparents. What does it mean to have an identity that continues even after you've sort of forgotten things? So.
Yeah.
So that was my concern. At the same time, because of those concerns, I was reading Catholic writers.
Right.
I was reading even sort of quasi-Catholic writers like Stanley Hauerwas. Yeah. I loved Stanley Hauerwas. Mm-hmm. And because he wrote about, because, well, first of all, he's kind of a jerk. He's kind of, he curses a lot. And like, I mean, he's a great theologian. I love him. But like he's a cantankerous Texan guy. Mm-hmm. He's funny, which I loved. And he would write, he was a theologian who wrote a lot about people with intellectual disabilities mm-hmm. and the challenge that like loving them has towards our sort of system of theology and what it means to yeah. sort of be Christians and what does it mean to have a liturgy that doesn't require you to understand things. Mm-hmm. That's a big thing that sort of I started wondering about where my liturgy that I grew up with in the Presbyterian church, you had to know what was going on.
Right.
And you had to really pay attention to know what was going on.
Yeah.
Whereas more high church traditions, you can just go. And even if you don't understand what's going on, it'll still happen. Mm-hmm. The liturgy will still happen without you.
Right.
Or, I mean, but it's not actually without you. You're there.
Yeah.
But it's like the sacrifice happens. Mm-hmm. And like you receive Jesus, even if you don't exactly know exactly everything that's going on.
Right.
Whereas in more Protestant traditions, or at least growing up Presbyterian, Reformed Presbyterian, it's like if you weren't paying attention, or mm-hmm. if you didn't know exactly what was going on, it just didn't work.
Yeah,
it's almost like you had to sort of produce the result of the liturgy.
I've always found it ironic that we have again this caricature of Catholicism that Catholicism is works righteousness.
Yes,
you have to do a bunch of stuff to be saved, but if you actually look at the theology as it unpacks and gets into practice, you end up with the opposite oftentimes
right.
between Catholicism and various Protestant denominations.
Sure, sure.
You end up with a very, like, you need to, yeah, your intellect, you know, your work, your participation, whereas, again, with the Catholic liturgy, we would say that those are good, those are helpful.
Right.
But it's not primarily you.
Yes.
It is primarily God and His grace, and we're just showing up.
Yeah, and like so much of it, and this is true, I think, of converts,
yeah.
both to Catholicism or away from Catholicism, is that you have this baggage that you hold, mm-hmm. and then when you convert to anything, really, yeah. you feel like it's been lifted. You yeah. feel like, oh, well, now everything makes sense.
Yeah.
And it's very easy to project that onto everyone. Mm-hmm. So it's very easy for me to project my pain growing up mm-hmm. onto Calvinism in general.
Mm-hmm.
Right. But I know plenty of Calvinists who do not have that attitude
yeah.
towards life.
Yeah.
And that like the presence of violence definitely changed the nature of the theological formation.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you can get away with a lot of, you know, theological issues and whatever. But when you add the presence of violence or violation to it, it really does like corrupt everything in the theology. Now everything seems twisted, and then it's very easy to sort of like project that onto the theology in general. Mm. So I do want to be fair to Calvinists, right? You know, and but at the same time, that was my experience.
Sure.
And but at the, you know, when you start talking about it's easy when you like, you know, comparing the two. I was always told growing up that that, you know, once saved, always saved. Mm-hmm. That, and then, but whereas Catholics were full of anxiety, mm-hmm. because they didn't know if they were going to heaven or not. They didn't know if they were saved. Mm-hmm. And I found it to be the opposite, because one thing I remember asking my pastor, I was like, okay, so once saved, always saved. Sure. Let's say that's true. How do we know if we're one of the ones that are saved? And the answer boils down to like, well, you die a Christian. Like you end, you make it to the end. That's the only way you really know. And I'm like, okay, so then what's the difference between that and a Catholic who, just like a Protestant, repents when they sin and confesses their sins and then dies in, like, having not, like, apostatized? Mm-hmm. What's the difference? He's like, well, I don't know. And this is like a very educated,
that's a good honest answer.
Right? It's an honest answer. And it's like, okay, well, so, and it reminds me a lot of, like, you know, like believing in soulmates, mm-hmm. like people who believe in soulmates. And it's like, well, okay, let's say soulmates are true. How do you know your wife is your soulmate?
Yeah.
Well, you know when you die, like, when one of you dies first at an old age or something, right? Right? Then you know that's your soulmate. But, like, people who are like, oh, you know, my wife's my soulmate. Well, they get divorced a year later. It's like, oh, well, it just turns out they weren't. That wasn't the soulmate. Just like when Judas, mm-hmm. like, betrayed Jesus. Oh, well, it just turns out he wasn't one of the elect or whatever, you know.
Yeah.
Or when someone, like, leaves the faith after being, you know, a pastor for 30 years. Oh, well, it just turns out they weren't actually one of the elect, even though, like, they felt that way their whole life. Like, so, logically, there's really, I don't see much difference. Mm-hmm. And for me, at least, I knew that even if I, like, wasn't, like, you know, emotionally lined up with everything, I knew going into confession that if I confessed my sins, I'd be forgiven. Mm-hmm. And that, it, you know, sins are, this is Richard John Neuhaus always talked about, because I read First Things in college, and I was, mm-hmm. like, really interested in that.
Yeah.
And, like, so I loved reading his thing about, like, sins objectively confessed and objectively forgiven. Mm-hmm. And you know that even if you weren't that sorry for it, mm-hmm. right, you go to confession and you, I mean, you should be sorry for it, but even if you were only doing it to stay away from hell,
yeah.
right, that it's still forgiven. Mm-hmm. And you don't have to think about it that much anymore. You don't have to, like, rue about it. You don't have to go back to old sins and, like, mm-hmm. you know, like, obsess over them or anything. You just, it's done.
Yeah.
And it's boring, right? Confession should be boring. It's not interesting because mm-hmm. your sins are not interesting. Mm-hmm. And so that's one thing that I loved about coming to Catholicism, away from the Presbyterian church. But one thing I noticed is that when I did that, my anxiety didn't go away. Mm. My anxiety was still there, which meant it wasn't about theology, right? Which meant it wasn't something that, like, theological issues could fix. There was something deep in there that was not just about getting it right. So when I was in college, I basically read my way into the church, like a lot of people, very intellectual. But I didn't know any Catholics, and I was still treating Catholicism as a set of, I mean, I was still treating Christianity as a set of propositions to be believed in. Mm-hmm. And so I became convinced in college that Catholicism was true, mm-hmm. that the proposition of beliefs of the Catholic Church was true, right? But I didn't convert. I didn't become Catholic, because why do you need to become Catholic? You can just believe this stuff.
Right.
And at the same time, you can go to whatever church you want to. But after college, I moved to Chicago, where I moved into a LARSH. LARSH is a network of communities where people with and without intellectual disabilities live together. Mm-hmm. And I knew I wanted to do that. I found out about LARSH by reading Stanley Hauerwas. And so I moved into a LARSH. And I was like, well, this is it, right? This is the community. And it's not just the community that I can put my heart into. It's also the community that's going to fix me. And the founder, Jean Vanier, talks about that a lot. And now it turns out there's a reason he talks about that a lot, because it turns out Jean Vanier was a sexual predator. And this was a huge like crisis in the church.
Oh dear.
And yeah, it was horrible. And that like this type of community will heal your brokenness. Will fix that hole in your heart. And people with disabilities, relationships with them can heal you, you know, et cetera. And I thought it was beautiful, and I was ready to rush in. And when I got there, these Catholic communities, I got there, what I witnessed was a lot of abuse. There was abuse there led by one of the people. And I did what I was supposed to do. I reported it. I reported the abuse at L'Arche. And the community, the Catholic community around L'Arche, launched in defense of the person that I had reported. And so, and this is before, or at least it's separate from the larger abuse scandal,
right.
Which I was not really aware of at the time, just vaguely aware of. But I had my own little sort of microcosm of just collapse in, because I was like ready to convert. Like I was in a Catholic community now in Chicago. I knew Catholics. We went to Catholic Mass with the clients and everybody else. And I was ready to do it. And I told on this woman who was abusive to the clients. And they all rallied around her and against me. And for some weird reason, I stayed. And the investigation happened, and I was vindicated as, no, I was right. And and she was wrong, and she ended up having to leave. But it was still, it was very traumatic for me to not just sort of relive the abuse that I had growing up, but also to be betrayed and to see the church, or not the church, but, you know, Catholics sort of try and cover it up, try to do it. And so even though I was all ready to convert, I didn't. Okay. So this is my second almost conversion, and I decide not to. And so throughout my time at L'Arche, I fell into a very deep depression partly because of this experience. Yeah. But also because just it wasn't fixing me. There wasn't this, I wasn't being cured of whatever I thought was wrong with me, you know. So I left L'Arche. I moved back to Charleston, which is where I'm from, born and raised. And I got a job working at the Disabilities Board of Charleston County, where I was teaching clients, or I was teaching caregivers. I was in charge of training caregivers on how to investigate abuse, how to relate to people with disabilities. And at the same time, I started going to a bar that called the Tin Roof, which I love and still love. And they had an open mic night for comedy. And so I started doing stand-up. And doing stand-up at that point, this is 2012, 2013, was so cathartic for me, because now it was just, I mean, it wasn't just an opportunity to prove I was smarter than everybody in the audience, which I love. It was also a way of processing everything that happened to me and everything that would happen to me on a daily basis through the lens of humor. And one of the things that trauma does to you is it makes you feel like your inner experience is not relatable to other people. That whatever happened to you is not going to connect with other people. And so you shouldn't even tell anyone, whatever. But as I started sort of narrating my own inner life and, you know, what I thought was funny, when it connects with the audience, when it makes them laugh, you know that you've made a connection. And that is just such a beautiful thing. So I'm doing stand-up. Go ahead.
Yeah, well, actually, let's take a break there.
Sure.
I don't want to get too far into the second half of the hour, but we'll come back and yeah, this is going to bring you to ultimately to your present vocation, your present project. So
cool.
We'll be back in just a couple minutes to hear the rest of Jeremy's story. See you then. Welcome back to the Journey Home program. We're entering the second half of our hour tonight, hearing Jeremy McClellan's conversion story, his testimony. He's a former Presbyterian. He now does comedy. And when we left off, we were just sort of getting to that part of the story where that enters in into the story. So
yeah. So I was in Charleston and started going to open mics for stand-up. And if you don't know what open mic is, basically you have 5 minutes to do whatever you want.
Yeah.
And it's never that good.
Yeah.
But you try and build on it. We know which jokes work. You become friends. I became friends with other comedians. And we would like write together. We would try to figure out. And there was something really beautiful about it because, like when you're writing comedy, it's silly, sure. And there's an element where it's play, where you're playing with words, and it's play in a very rich sense of leisure and like this is what you're supposed to do with your life, you know.
Yeah.
When you are able to then connect that to another person in a way that makes them laugh, you've made a very deep connection that isn't just, oh, you agree on something. Like agreeing on something is a very superficial connection because, you think about it. Finding something that's funny or finding out what someone else thinks is funny, learning what makes someone else laugh and then somehow doing that, like that's a very deep knowledge of the other person.
Yeah.
Because going back to my abuse and sort of healing from that, that's how, the first time you ever laugh as a child is when your mother plays peekaboo with you. And peekaboo is such a just beautiful thing because if you think about it, it's so dark. It's such a dark experience for the child to have the mother who's the ground of their existence just disappear. Mm-hmm. And there's something very like deeply terrifying about that. And then suddenly they're there again and all is right with the world. And you learn growing up that like all is right with the world. Mm-hmm. And I didn't have that experience. I grew up thinking that like I was totally different from other people, that I was rotten and that like what I experienced could not be connected with others. And comedy sort of taught me otherwise. And another thing I was doing when I was doing stand-up was I was talking about experiences that I had had with people with intellectual disabilities. Mm-hmm. And some of them stories are just wild and really funny. Some of the experiences that I had were being a caregiver to people who were Pakistani Muslim. And the experience that I had being a Christian, but being a caregiver for Muslims was where it's like my job to help them be good Muslims. Mm. Which is a weird relationship to have with people, you know? And so I was telling stories about that. And this was right around the time that Trump first ran for office. And so I was going viral being a pretty conservative Christian, talking knowledgeably about Muslims, about my experience as Muslims, not talking about like the difference in the theologies or whatever, but just like the, you know, and I was exhibiting knowledge of Islam and Pakistan. Like a cultural knowledge of that. It went super viral in the Muslim community and the Pakistani community. And I got all these requests to come and speak, to come and do comedy, to come and do stand-up at these Muslim events. And there was no other Christian in the world who was being, and as far as I know, still not, whose like main fan base and, you know, doing comedy was like, for like, there's no Christian who's going around performing in mosques, basically, except for me. And again, I like, okay, I'll toot my own horn about that. Like no one else is doing this. It's great. And I still do that. And so, this put me into dialogue, in the presence of Muslims. I had Muslim friends, but they were not the kind of Muslim friends who would try to convert you, who would try to argue with you. Meanwhile, I'm getting booked at these like mosques all over the world where people would, and where I was meeting like top scholars like Yasser Qadhi, who felt that it was their mission to try to convert me to Islam because I was already very popular. And there's something like Muslims tend to love like white converts to Islam. Cause like, well, if they're white and they believe Islam, it's definitely true, you know? Also they loved me. And when you love someone, you want to share your faith with them and you want to, expose them to that. And I was still sort of wrestling with like, what do I believe? And one thing that Muslims are very, laser focused on is the idea that there is this huge gap, between now for them, the gap is, Jesus, This is like what Muslims think, that Jesus was a prophet, and then his followers like corrupted the story.
Right.
And so there's this big gap. The Protestant story is that Jesus and the disciples were right, and then the followers corrupted the story. So there is this still gap, mm-hmm. and I was confronted with this. And at the same time, I was also confronted with the fact that Islam, at least the people that I was exposed to, that I became friends with and loved, that for them, religion was not a list of propositions about their faith. It was an entire way of life. It was a deen. It was a, you know, a holistic view of harmony of the universe. And I was really wondering why that was not the case for me, why my belief in Christianity was this series of propositions. And but at the same time, it's not that my life was a series of propositions. Your life has to come from somewhere. People still have a way of life. And you either get it from, you know, a baptized view of the world, or you get it from the larger culture. And so I think over time, Christianity, you know, we have seen Christianity since the Reformation sort of become this, this either a spiritual sense or a list of beliefs. Mm-hmm. And but having it impact your view of economics,
right.
your view of like the human person, mm-hmm. your view of science, your view of like war, you know, like does theology have anything to say about war? Mm-hmm. Like that is something that like, oh, well, and it turns out like we've outsourced, I use the term outsourcing, we've outsourced so much of our faith
yes.
to the larger culture so that all that's left is sort of a sense that we have a relationship with God or a relationship with something. That's the sort of more New Agey thing, or on the right, a list of intellectual beliefs about the Trinity or whatever. Mm-hmm. But if that was the case, then why did God not just send down a pamphlet explaining the Trinity?
Yeah.
Why do you need the story of redemption? Why do you need the incarnation? If the Trinity can just be explained with a drawing of three knots and stuff. Mm-hmm. And then like, why do we have a church? Why do we have, why has Jesus not come back yet? Like, what's this, like, what's all this extra stuff doing in Christianity
right.
if it's not just like the shorter Westminster Catechism? Mm-hmm. And so being confronted with Islam, which is a very attractive, I do find Islam to be a very compelling, faith. Mm-hmm. Maybe not the Islam you see on the news, but the ones that I know, it is very compelling and very lovely and beautiful. And so why am I not a Muslim, right? There was that, and I was never tempted by Islam in any sort mm-hmm. of deep sense, but I was challenged by it because, like, what in the world, like, form of Christianity can compete with that,
right.
you know? And I don't mean competition in some sort of, like, dark sense. I mean just, like, you know, what makes our story more beautiful than theirs?
Yeah. Well, and where do you find, I think one of the attractive things about Islam is that, again, those who practice it, it like you said, there's no neutral territory in their lives.
Sure.
It affects everything.
Yes.
You know, and the idea that you'd have a theology that sort of stays in its box and only can tell you about certain parts of your
yes.
life, but doesn't really have much to say about the rest.
Right.
That doesn't make any sense. Like, we know that in our hearts. It doesn't make sense.
Right. And what's interesting is that a lot of people see the only way to sort of neuter Islam politically is to encourage that kind of separation, that Islamic Reformation, supposedly, where if we can just get Muslims to believe that Islam is just this one thing and then outsource the rest, then we'll have peace or something, which is not going to happen. But it's interesting that like the State Department sees that as a goal. But if that's a process that neuters of religion, then what happened to ours? Mm-hmm. Has ours been, you know, in that sense? Maybe not by the State Department, but by, you know, other forces. And so what I found, I found Islam to be beautiful, but in a way that drew me to what I wanted, which was a form of Christianity that actually spoke to my entire life. And I knew from all my previous conversion experiences that that was the Catholic Church. And so I remember having arguments with Muslims and then being in a hotel room in Chicago, right? And I was in pain from the doubt and uncertainty of my arguments with, like, with Muslims, but also the like depression and anxiety and like the, you know, memories of childhood and stuff like that. And I had this sort of like ineffable, I say ineffable experience of the Virgin Mary, where I felt mothered and I felt the presence of Mary, who I assume was on a layover as well in like Holiday Inn at the Chicago airport, right? When I came home from that trip, I told my wife that I wanted to become Catholic. And just to back up for a second, my wife, who I met while I was starting to do comedy, which is a great time to meet your wife when you start doing comedy. you don't want to meet someone before you start doing comedy, because then you end up like you have a job and you tell your wife you want to be a comic. That's like telling your wife you want to be a rapper. You know, it's just a huge red flag. You also don't want to be an established comedian and then try and like date fans or something. So she like I wasn't good yet, but she had faith in me. And she knew that I could, you know, that I could do it. And so that was beautiful. My wife is a cradle Catholic. And she had lapsed at this point. And we got married. It was a Protestant sort of wedding on a beach, like on a thing. And then she became pregnant with our daughter, Jewel. And she ended up, when I came back and I was like, I want to become Catholic, it was not like for her having lapsed, it was also like it wasn't like, oh, finally Jeremy's home in the Catholic Church. It was also like, well, what do I believe? Mm-hmm. And is it enough that I believe? And so me coming back brought her back. And even though like she was not, like she was a lapsed Catholic and I was like a new Catholic. And, so I met with a priest and, I already knew everything about like Catholic Church, or at least what I thought was everything. Like, you know, what converts think is everything, right, which is the intellectual stuff.
Right, right.
But I didn't know any of the culture, any of the ritual, any of the practices, burying Joseph upside down in your yard to sell your house kind of stuff. I didn't know any of that. My wife is the expert on all of that. Comes from a long line of Polish Catholics, and but I didn't know any of that. But I know I have strong opinions on whether like Meister Eckhart should have been tried for heresy by the Inquisition in like this, you know, back in the day. And I have strong opinions on that. But I couldn't tell you what the different like bowls and stuff are in the Catholic Church, or even like even what's going to happen next in Mass.
Yeah.
So, that was a challenge for me, because I think there's a tendency for people who convert from Protestantism to Catholicism, because they're searching for stability. And for me, it was doctrinal, it was theological, but it was also about lifestyle, and it was also because the intellectual work had been done back in college,
right?
10 years before, I was convinced that like no, this is what Christians have always believed in some form or another, and but converting to Catholicism, it was not just changing beliefs. It was about converting to a world. And one thing that really struck with me was this quote by St. Thomas, where he says that propositions do not terminate in propositions. They terminate in the reality that they describe. And that's sort of complicated. But we have a doctrine of transubstantiation. But we do not worship the doctrine of transubstantiation. And we worship Jesus. And we do not. So growing up, I always thought the difference between Catholics and Protestants was that Protestants believed that, Catholics believed in transubstantiation, and Protestants didn't, right? But that's actually not the difference. The difference is that transubstantiation happens in Catholic churches, and it doesn't happen in Protestant churches. So it's not a difference of belief about the Eucharist. It's the Eucharist. And the same is true of, baptism is the same, but the same is true of like all these other things where like, no, this is where Christ like is fully like, this is where the kingdom of God fully subsists. This is the kingdom of God on earth. And so once you realize that, then it becomes necessary to convert. Mm-hmm. Whereas before, I could always just have these sort of beliefs, whatever. Mm-hmm. So converting to that and entering the church that way. On Easter Vigil, after a show, I got home like, you know, 10 minutes before. I had to hurry home. But one thing that sort of I had to get over was translating, trying to sort of, because one thing that I've noticed Protestants do is treat tradition like sola scriptura. Mm-hmm. And so, because they want stability, they want certainty. Right. And so their idea is just like, well, just replace the Bible's certainty with like the church. And that's not how it works either.
Papal documents, whatever it is.
Find something that a church father said one time. Sure. And then that's like, you know, as if the Quran, if the Bible was the Quran that fell from the sky, or the church was.
Right.
And another thing that I had to get, that I had to sort of get past was I still had this deep desire to be fixed. And so that didn't go away when I became Catholic. It just got mutated into scrupulosity, where instead I thought, well, if I just say the rosary enough, then it'll be fixed. And, or if I just, you know, say these prayers, go to confession enough times for every little tiny thing, then I'll be fixed. And that's not how it works either. And so even after I converted to Catholicism, there was this continual conversion of like, no, like, I'm good. Like, there was this realization that I've had. And one thing I love, Hans Urs von Balthasar, a theologian, he has this great thing where he talks about, and this is related to peekaboo that I talked about earlier, was that Jesus learned that the world was good, however Jesus learned things.
Yeah.
Jesus learned that the world was good in the face of Mary. Mm. And that it was growing, being a baby and seeing the face of Mary and knowing that the world was good and that it was worth dying for. And that just like killed me, because I was like realizing that and realizing through my devotions and through education but also just being a part of the Catholic Church, realizing that like the world is sound, the world is good.
Yeah.
It's not hopelessly corrupt. Mm-hmm. I'm not hopelessly corrupt. There's like, that's not what the fall is.
Yeah.
The fall does not make everything rotten to the core. Mm-hmm. And like realizing that and seeing that dovetailed into comedy, because comedy only works if we're talking about a reality that is good.
Yeah.
Because that's what makes people laugh, is being, I think that at its core, comedy is being surprised by something good, mm-hmm. right? Horror is when you're surprised by something bad. Mm-hmm. But like comedy, you have to be surprised, first of all. Mm-hmm. You have to not see the punchline coming, and it has to be good mm-hmm. in order for you to laugh, right? Yeah. And that process, I think, just reiterates the fundamental conviction that that this world is loved by God and it's good, mm-hmm. and so that's where I came today.
You mentioned earlier leisure in connection to that, right? Because that's this. I'm not sure if you were explicitly
Joseph Pieper, he's the man.
But we have this backwards. It's funny, the relationship between the work and the Sabbath.
Yes,
it's this. It connects to this theme that goes up and down through theology, psychology, our development. It's just this question of do I do stuff and then I'm good and God loves me?
Yes.
Or does God love me first?
Yes.
And then out of that identity, then that I do good.
Right. And when someone tells a joke during a eulogy for someone, and everybody laughs, that's not a break from reality.
Yeah.
That is the reality.
Yeah.
And that's more real than the death that's there.
Yes.
And every comedian that I know thinks I'm overthinking this, but I really think it's true that comedy and humor, people who have a hard day at work, mm-hmm. right, and they come home and they watch comedy on television, mm-hmm. they will talk about it like they need a break from reality, you know. But I'm like, no, that's the good stuff, mm-hmm. right? That humor that you have with your spouse, with whatever, that's not a break. That is like the kingdom of God. That's you demonstrating the kingdom. It's not making an argument. Hold on a second. You're not making an argument, like sort of apologetics. People think that comedy is sort of a part of apologetics where you're trying to be funny about stuff and you slip in the truth, you know. Mm-hmm. But it's not a way of like sort of sweetening up these arguments for the faith.
Right.
It's just demonstrating the reality that you're inviting people to. Mm-hmm. So like, you know, I'm inviting people to be a part of this, mm-hmm. to be a part of the joy and the comedy of the divine comedy, right?
Yeah.
Of reality that's like actually true.
Mm-hmm.
I don't have any like good arguments that people haven't really heard before.
Yeah.
For especially like to Muslims, like when I perform for Muslims, I'm talking about religion, I'm talking about all this stuff. I don't have these arguments about like why you should convert to Islam, etc.
Yeah.
But it is this demonstration of the kingdom,
mm-hmm.
then that I am in a way inviting people to.
Yeah, yeah, and that ultimately that is the ultimate apologetic argument, is whether or not you live out the implications of that true theology,
mm-hmm.
which is that again, first and foremost, I'm loved by God.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and out of that, yes, I obey and I go to church and I do all the things and I receive and I serve, but it comes from God's
yes.
prior action.
Right.
It's His. It's grace alone.
Yes. You know, like
it
right.
Starts,
yeah.
It starts with grace.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, we have about 4 minutes left, but you know, like reconnecting this back to some of the themes earlier in the story. I mean, this anthropology, this view of human nature and grace, you know, and then where our work fits into it and all that. I mean, that gives that answer to those questions you had
yes.
about, well, what about the disabled? What about me when I'm a baby? What about
right.
me when I'm too old to understand this stuff anymore? You know, that view of human nature fits our experience.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah, we're loved first. And we're fundamentally loved by God, chosen, cherished. And then out of that, we love and we're loved.
And in a way, you know, we're loved by our mother even before the mother knows we exist.
Mm-hmm.
There is this weird moment between the time of conception and the time the mother finds out she's pregnant,
mm-hmm.
where she's a mother and she doesn't know it.
Yeah.
And I've always loved that that thing where like, and the father's a father without knowing it yet either.
Yeah.
But they are, so like that relationship precedes
mm-hmm.
this like knowledge of that.
Yeah.
And, I think we've become used to seeing the only responsibilities we have, the only relationships we really have, are ones that we have freely agreed to,
mm.
right? The ones that we have fully consented to. And that comes from economics, the market, whatever. Yeah. The only king you have is one that you voted for, et cetera.
Right. Liberalism and the big philosophical
yes. So
sense,
everything is based on consent, just raw consent,
right.
Not consent plus anything about the human person or flourishing. It's just consent. And I mean, I forgot where I was going with that, but yeah, like yeah. So it turns out that like when we come online, first of all, we come online through language,
mm-hmm.
Through which we're able to understand ourselves, language that we did not invent,
mm-hmm.
right? All of our thoughts are in a language that we did not invent. So we have inherited all of this first. We have inherited these relationships first. We already find ourselves in a web of obligations. And that's how we become people. That's how we understand ourselves. So we are already in debt almost when you come online. And it's true. We are loved not just by God first in sort of a grace formula, but by everyone that we know, all of our ancestors, everyone in our community. We are already loved by them when we, like, before we even realize it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a great gift to family. And Chesterton points this out I think the book Heretics, whatever. But he's talking about how the gift of family is that you're born, you know, it's not your choice. You're born
right.
into a family. You know, they didn't choose you. You didn't choose them.
Sure, yeah.
You're given to each other.
Mm-hmm.
And before you enter out into the world where it is, you know, consent and relationships and contracts, you're born into a family where no one chose each other.
Right.
You're just given to each
yes.
other. Yeah. Well, with about a minute left, if there's
okay.
somebody, again, from a similar background to you, kind of the Reform background, really broadly speaking, this very intellectual background, but something's missing, give them a word of encouragement on their journey forward.
Well, I think just any way you can, find a way to incorporate all of, see redemption
yeah.
as cosmic, as something that is about every part of your life. And, you know, look up resources for integrating your faith with every aspect of your life. And I think that the best way to do that is through the Catholic tradition, obviously. I'm Catholic. But I think that anytime you can like search your way into making your religion not just a list of propositions, but about your entire way of life, your entire person, you know, don't leave any part of you unaffected by Christ.
Yeah.
I think that road leads to Rome, but hopefully it at least leads to heaven.
Yeah, one step at a time.
Yeah.
All right. Thank you so much.
All right. Thank you so much.
Sharing your story. And you, actually, you can reach out to Jeremy for booking inquiries. Mm-hmm. If you, we'll have the email address up on the screen, jeremy.mcclellan@gmail.com. So you can reach out to him there to book one of his shows. So thanks again, Jeremy. Thank you for being with us on this episode of the Journey Home program. I pray that Jeremy's story is an inspiration to you. Remember that you're loved. You're loved even before you pray, even before you speak, even before you act, even before you figure out which is the right church. God loves you, and just take the next step in that journey with him today. God bless you. We'll see you again next week.